Well, this is exciting. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and I had no idea. They kept it a secret from me all day. Jimmy Akin in studio with us. Haven't gotten to be in studio with Jimmy in a long, long while. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. By the way, it's an open forum today. You can call 888-3. I can't even remember the number. I'm so excited. 888-318-7884. 888-31-TRUTH. Ask Jimmy whatever you like. Hello, Jimmy Akin. It's
Hello,
nice to see you in person.
Yeah.
Really
Without
nice.
The internet in between us.
I know. I'm a little flustered because I didn't know you were coming.
Well, that was by design. You know, I let everybody on the radio staff know I would be coming except you.
Oh, well.
Because you're special.
Well, I guess I am. I don't know if I got left out of the loop, but that's like it's like having a surprise party. It's like
yeah,
a little surprise party.
That was the idea.
And looking very sharp in your white and your cowboy hat.
Thank you.
It's great to see you again, Jimmy.
Yeah, likewise.
And in this new studio setting?
New studio. So I like the fact that you and I can now see the clock together.
Yes.
Because that was never the case before. Because when they had the guests sit over here, the guest, it's like, what does the guest count for anything? The guest doesn't need to know how close we are to the break.
No, and so the guy only, answering the question doesn't
yeah,
need to know.
So the only way to tell would be to, like, look, and it looks like you're being rude to the, you know, like you're rolling your eyes, and all you're really doing yeah. is checking what time it is, how much time do we have left before the break.
Well, also, they put the clock under the camera, which mm-hmm. I always thought it looked so weird because I have to check the clock. That's
yeah.
part of my job.
You have to
but
look
Jimmy's,
up. Again, it looks like
yeah,
you're rolling
Jimmy's
your eyes.
Jimmy's giving an answer, and I'm like, look at, like, it literally looks like you're just like, oh, Jimmy Akin again with one of those answers.
Yeah.
So it's nice. It looks good. And it's just so nice to have you here, Jimmy. I've really missed you. It's been more than a year since I've seen you in person.
It has been more than a year, yeah.
Well, this is exciting. I don't even want to go to calls. I just want to sit and talk with Jimmy Akin. Do I have to go to calls? Am I required? The number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Oh, another good sign. Things getting better. Jimmy Akin in the studio with us. All right, I'm going to get myself together because this really was a surprise. Like you timed it perfectly, too. Like,
well, that was the idea. I wanted to walk in. You know, told them, feel free to tell Cy that, you know, you're not able to raise me on Skype, which is true because I'm not there to answer it. So,
well, they kept me pretty distracted. I mean, they were Mary and Zach were in here pretending to do a podcast for like 10 minutes before, and I was like, we're about to do a radio show, you know, like we need to start. And you walked. That's
yeah.
pretty good. All right, I guess I have to go to callers apparently. So,
okay,
let's go to Shreveport, Louisiana, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. Connor in Shreveport, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for the actual physical Jimmy Akin.
Hello.
Hi, Connor.
I was talking to an atheist, mm-hmm. and he was asking me for proofs of God, and I explained to him that you can't use science to prove God, since it's a tool for studying the natural world instead of supernatural worlds. And so I said, you can only use rational arguments to show the likeness of God. And he said that you can only use presuppositions if they're axioms. And I just want to know Jimmy's thoughts on that.
Well, not having been a party to the conversation, I'm not entirely sure what he meant by everything he said. In regard to the first claim that you can't use science to investigate the existence of God, I'm not sure that I buy that. I know there are people, including some very respected people, who would say that. I would certainly say there are limitations to what you can do with science in investigating God. You can't investigate God scientifically the same way you could investigate, say, earthquakes or various natural phenomena, because God is not a natural phenomenon. God is beyond nature. At the same time, you can, in one way or another, look at nature to get information that you can then use to reason your way to the existence of God. And sometimes that's done in a more philosophical mode, like, say, with Aquinas' arguments for, his famous five ways of demonstrating God's existence. But it can also be done in other ways. I mean, there are arguments that get made from elements of design in the universe that people would say, well, this shows that the universe had a designer who is plausibly understood as God. And there are various versions of that. Sometimes people will point to the fact that the cosmological constants in our universe seem to be finely tuned for life. Sometimes I've even seen it argued, although I'm much more skeptical of this, that the arrangement of bodies in our solar system seems fine-tuned for life. And those are both scientifically based fine-tuning arguments for God's existence. Other people have suggested there's elements of design in biology. Advocates of so-called intelligent design will point to things that characterize, you know, the fundamental mechanisms in cells, for example, as evidence of design and thus a designer. So I think there are ways, at least potentially, of using science to try to reason our way to God. But obviously we can't study God the way we can study a volcano or something like that. In terms of his claim, I'm less sure what he means. A presupposition and an axiom are basically the same thing. In mathematics and philosophy and logic, an axiom is something you take to be true even though you can't prove it. And axioms can be supported in different ways, like by intuition. Many axioms seem just obviously true, like, you know, nothing can be both true and false at the same time. That's called the principle of non-contradiction. And people will say, well, it just seems obviously true that nothing can be both true and false at the same time. But you can't prove it, because in order to prove it, you would have to employ the principle of non-contradiction, and so your proof would be circular. And as a result, every system of logic and mathematics has axioms at its root, and you can use these axioms, which are things you presuppose because you don't have any way of proving them. You can use axioms or presuppositions to reason your way to God. Very few arguments for God's existence rest exclusively on presuppositions, though. You could argue that some arguments, like what's called the ontological argument for God's existence, that would be exclusively based on axioms. But most arguments for God's existence include something else. They will frequently include an observation about the universe, even if it's a very general one that we wouldn't call necessarily scientific. Like in Aquinas's Five Ways, for example, one of his five ways is the argument from motion, which he really means the argument from change. And it not only includes some axioms, but it also includes the observation that in the universe we see change. We see lots of things changing, and so we need to figure out a satisfactory explanation for the changes we see. And Aquinas then uses that to reason his way to God. So that's kind of a general sketch of what I'd say, given my understanding of what happened in the conversation, but maybe you can tell me if that helps or not.
Yes, sir, it does. So basically just a summary is that presuppositions are axioms.
They certainly can be conceived the same way. They're very similar. Someone might be able to draw a distinction between them, but I need to hear their proposal for how they're defining the two terms. But one thing I would say is we are not presupposing the existence of God. We're presupposing certain general principles or axioms that we can then use to reason our way to God's existence deductively or inductively.
Oh, yes, sir. All right. Well, thank you, sir.
Sure thing.
Thanks, Connor, for starting us off. Jimmy Akin, live in studio, both hours today. It's open forum. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. And suddenly I have a hankering for Japanese food. I don't, you know what that might have to do with, Jimmy?
Yeah, I do. I also have an idea how you could satisfy that.
Oh, thanks.
Order Japanese food.
Well, thank you very much. I'll explain it on the other side. We'll be right back with more open forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Now there's a fast and easy way to get in touch with EWTN, the EWTN Everything Number. Call 1-800-447-EWTN to get the latest information on programming, special events, pilgrimages, and more. Our EWTN Family Viewer Services representatives are ready to help you with whatever your needs may be. The EWTN Everything Number, 1-800-447-EWTN. EWTN.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Really, the only person I ever go out for Japanese food with is Jimmy Akin. So that's why I started, as soon as I saw him, I started getting this craving for Japanese food.
Well, we'll have to do that again sometime soon.
I hope we will. Thank you. In the studio with us, Dave Matheson, Director of Development here, but not here to talk about development, here to talk about another good sign that things are getting going again. What is it, Dave?
It is. Well, with Jimmy Akin back in the studio, it's like the Earth has been off its axis a little bit.
Yeah.
And now it's back on its axis,
getting there.
Or very close.
Yeah, right.
So we're really excited. Good to see you, Jimmy.
Yeah, likewise, Dave.
Glad you're here. And we will be seeing you as well at the Catholic Answers Conference, which is coming back after a one-year hiatus this September. It is, as our president, Christopher Cech, likes to call it, the greatest and largest Catholic party in the world.
Yeah.
It is a very fun event and is going to take place, as it always does, prior to last year, the last weekend of September, the 23rd through the 26th.
And you can find, first of all, you can find out about it at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
That's
CatholicAnswersConference.com. There's a early bird. We usually do this, and we're doing it again this year. There will be early bird pricing, which I think gets you a great deal. It's like you can do the whole conference for $129, I think.
This is the best deal in America on a Catholic conference. If there's a better deal, I want to see it. I don't think it's out there. But yes, if you go to CatholicAnswersConference.com, spell it all out, enter the code EARLY, and you will get $30 off your ticket. There are two types of tickets. There's one that will just be a talks only. There's another ticket that will get you access to all of the dinners, the banquets, receptions, et cetera. One thing to keep in mind is we will have Bishop Joseph Strickland, who will be our guest speaker for the final banquet. So we're very excited to have him on board.
And we just found out we can do the conference, and there's already hundreds of people signed up.
We do. We have a couple hundred signed up already. We would love to pack the place. In the past, we've had 900 to 1,000 folks, and it looks like we're going to be able to do that again. So go now, get your tickets. There is also a special room rate if you want to stay at the Hyatt Regency La Jolla, beautiful sunny San Diego, right there on the coast. At the Hyatt, special room rate of $164 per night.
All right. CatholicAnswersConference.com. And will there be square dancing?
I hear there will be. Jimmy, will there be square dancing?
They asked me about that, and I said, sure, of course.
So. There you go. So if all the great speakers and Bishop Strickland and Paul Gondreau and Sister Mary Stella were not enough for you, there will be square dancing called by world-famous Jimmy Akin.
And from Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Well, I was apropos of that. We got an email, the speakers who were on staff got an email the other day saying, we want you to give us some material about, you know, to advertise with. And they didn't want to do the standard, just come to San Diego because it's sunny, you know, stuff. So they wanted like a description of your talk and things like that. And then they said something about you that's not, you know, widely known, that's not on your on your bio.
Yeah.
And so I was typing that response. I still need to send it in, but I was typing that response. And for my unusual fact, I'm on a first name basis with several of the government's former military psychic spies. So
there you go. That is
never ceases to amaze us, does it?
No, that's not always. We wouldn't expect that. You know, mine is like, I like spaghetti. Nobody knows that. Jimmy's like,
so one more time, Cy, CatholicAnswersConference.com. Use the code EARLY for $30 off your ticket.
And come. It is just going to be great.
It'll be so much fun coming back after a one-year hiatus. It's going to be even more fun than it usually is.
And you know
so
what else?
Excited.
It's all about Jesus. The whole conference is about Jesus.
It is. Who do you say that I am?
Yeah.
It is 100% about Jesus. And what better topic?
Amen.
Could we possibly have? And it's the whole show is going to be run by our very own Cy Kellett.
You say going to be run. No, I'm the MC. It's run by Erica.
Well,
she tells me what to
do. Yes. Erica Olson will be running the show, yeah. But Cy will
but I'll
be
saying
face,
what
the
she tells me to say.
Show.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. Exactly. And we'll be doing the radio show twice. We're going to
do the
Thursday show and then the Friday show from the conference.
For sure.
Go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. Thank you, David.
You bet. Thank you, Cy. And again, good to see you, Jimmy.
Likewise.
Glad you're here.
All right, let's go to Florida. Robert in Tallahassee, Florida, watching on YouTube. You are up next, Robert. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
All right. Hey, Jimmy. You published a video about 3 months ago titled, When Were the Gospels Written?
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the most interesting things that you claimed about the Gospel of John was that it was written before the year AD 70, before the destruction of the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of used the criterion of embarrassment. How accurate do you think it is to be able to use that for like the dating of the Gospels?
Okay, so I should explain for folks who may not be aware, the criterion of embarrassment is a tool that biblical scholars in particular have proposed for as a way of assessing whether something is accurate or not. Because, you know, people will challenge various things in the Bible and say, well, how do I know this is accurate? And they've basically borrowed the criterion of embarrassment from other settings in life. Like, for example, if you're in a law court, and you have a person who's on trial, let's say they're on trial for murder, you know, like Trent Horn might be, you know, maybe Cy Kellett's been murdered and Trent Horn is on trial for that.
Yeah.
And so they've got him on the stand and they're having him testify. And if Trent were to admit that he was at the scene of the murder within an hour of the murder, that would be somewhat embarrassing for Trent because it would make
right.
it more likely that he could be nailed for Cy Kellett's murder. And so as a result, it would be in Trent's interest not to admit that he was at the site of the murder within an hour of the murder. And if he goes ahead and admits it anyway, even though it would be in his interest not to admit that, then it's extra evidence that that admission is true. And the same thing can be applied in various biblical contexts, like when Jesus says in Matthew's gospel, when the person comes to him and says, good teacher, and Jesus replies, why do you call me good? There is none good but God. Well, that's not the kind of thing a later Christian would make up because very quickly it was recognized Jesus is God.
Yeah.
And so you wouldn't make up a saying where Jesus, at least on the surface, seems to question whether he should be identified with God. So that would be a sign that that particular passage is an authentic tradition that goes back to Jesus that wasn't simply made up at a later date. And we can apply the criterion of embarrassment in other ways, too. I've used it, for example, to argue the Exodus actually happened. Because if you're making up an origin story for your national epic, we were slaves in this puny little people that was dominated by another empire, and then we got away.
That's literally embarrassing.
Yeah, exactly. And so that would be a sign that the Exodus really happened. In terms of the Gospels, one of the things that I'd have to think about exactly how the criterion of embarrassment applies to the dating of the Gospels, I certainly wouldn't dismiss it. One of the main things that I do with the criterion of embarrassment and the New Testament era and the message of the Gospels is not as much about the dating of them as, again, about their accuracy. Because one of the things you have, now you have various people, and these are fringe people, but you do have some people who will say, well, Jesus never existed. He was just a myth. And they're called mythicists. And so one of the arguments I've developed is, well, okay, then how would you explain the emergence of Christianity? Because the Christians themselves admit that they are brand new. You know, you read the documents, the New Testament, they admit we're a brand new religion. And being brand new is maybe a good thing when it comes to a car model or an iPhone model, but being brand new is not a good thing when it comes to religion.
Right.
If you want to say we're a religion, you want to say we have this ancient wisdom and we're not brand new. And so for Christians to admit that they are a brand new religion that emerged only in the third decade of the first century is a significant admission, and that's likely to be true. So that gives us the logical starting point for when Christianity began, sometime around the year 30, plus or minus. And then it very quickly, within just 20 years, had gotten as far as Rome. And it was all over the Mediterranean world by the end of the first century. And so how would Christianity grow so rapidly if it was brand new? And the logical explanation is, well, okay, it obviously had a strong missionary impulse to spread itself. So where did that come from? Myths don't produce strong evangelistic programs. What does produce strong evangelistic programs are charismatic founders that say, go forth and evangelize. And you want to explain how Christianity appeared suddenly and spread rapidly, the logical explanation is there was a real historical figure at its beginning that gave it its missionary impulse. And all of the sources inside and outside the Bible that address that question say it was Jesus of Nazareth. And so I use the criterion of embarrassment in that way to support the reality of Jesus. Robert may have something else, because when you've written as much as I have, you don't remember everything you've written. But Robert, do you have a specific memory of how I applied the criterion of embarrassment to the dates of the Gospels?
Yes. It's specifically in John 5, mm-hmm. where John says, "Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, in Hebrew called Bethesda, which has five porticos." And you mentioned that that wouldn't have been there after the destruction of the temple.
Correct. It wouldn't have been there after AD 70, because the city of Jerusalem was razed down to the ground except for a few towers that Titus's army left standing. And so the portico in question was gone. Would I call that the criterion of embarrassment? If John had been writing after AD 70, I guess it would be a little embarrassing to say, hey, there's this place in Jerusalem, when in fact there wasn't. So I guess you could relate it in that way. But I do think that there are indications, and this is just my opinion on John. There are other people who share it. I should point out most scholars think John was written sometime in the AD 90s, but I think it was a little more than 20 years earlier than that, based on passages like that and some other factors.
Robert, thank you so much. Appreciate the question. It's an open forum for Jimmy Akin. Lots of folks on the line, so I'm going to keep moving. Thank you again, Robert. We go now to Carlos in Tucson, Arizona, watching on YouTube. Carlos, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I wanted to ask, as far as a Catholic reading mythology, mm-hmm. pagan mythology, is there any type of, is there any good reasons to read mythology without offending God?
Well, there certainly can be reasons to read mythology and that don't offend God. St. Paul was familiar with Greco-Roman literature, including their stories of the gods and things like that. And he had a special need to understand their religion, because he was trying to convert people from that background. And if you want to convert someone, you need to understand where they're coming from, and that includes their religious beliefs. So for, say, an apologist or an evangelist, there can be very good reasons. Also, the mythology, even when it's wrong, and you know a lot of it is wrong, but even when it's wrong, it contains elements of truth. It addresses fundamental questions. There are elements of truth that people like Eusebius of Pamphylia, the church early Christian writer, referred to as seeds of the gospel that had been planted out there for pagans to have as part of their culture, and they could then germinate once the gospel was actually preached to them. And so, you know, there are elements of truth and beauty and things that one can appreciate while recognizing that pagan mythology is not a reliable source of information, there can still be things to appreciate in it. For example, if you read the account of, let's say you read the Iliad and the Odyssey, you know, those are two works by Homer. The Iliad tells part of the story of the Trojan War, and then the Odyssey tells about Odysseus's return to his home in Ithaca. Not the one in New York, Cy.
Oh, I've always been confused by that.
Yeah, but his home Ithaca after the Trojan War. And there's more to say about that, so we'll say it on the other side of the break.
Hang on if you can, Carlos. We'll continue with this question and many more questions. It's open forum. Anyone welcome to call with any question at all for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Call us now with your question.
Hello?
On Catholic Answers Live.
According to divine command, we should give God worship, but how do we know if we're doing it right? Is worship a form of self-help? To make me feel better? A form of social activism or even a commodity? Or is it something that transcends all of those? In Real Religion, How to Avoid False Faith and Worship God in Spirit and Truth, Father Jeff Kirby cuts through the misguided modern notions about God and religion and takes you back to the foundation for true worship, God's revelation about himself. From his first contact with his chosen people to the culmination of his revelation in Jesus Christ, God shows us what religion is supposed to be like and how to make the practice of it a lifelong virtue in our lives. Order your copy of Real Religion by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Oh yeah, a little bit of groovy music from Sarah running the board. Thank you, Sarah, doing a great job. It's not a Thursday, though. I almost said, oh, it's a Thursday, groovy music, Jimmy Akin and all that. It's not, though. It's Friday, and we're having some extra fun today. Jimmy came into the studio for 2 hours of open forum, and thanks, Sarah, for playing the groovy music. Carlos is on the line in Tucson, Arizona. I wanted to know about, are there any good reasons why a Christian person would read pagan myths and in such a way that would not offend God? And so you were in the midst of answering, Carlos.
Yeah. So I was mentioning, you know, you could read, and Christians have read the Iliad and the Odyssey, you know, which are classic works of world literature.
I mean,
they were famous among the Greeks for a reason. They're really good stories, and they're really well told.
Right.
And just because they have a different religious background doesn't mean they're not good works of literature. As a kid, now obviously I wasn't reading it in Homeric Greek, but you know,
you say that like it's obvious, but would you, Jimmy? I don't know that that's obvious.
Well, you know, we would have versions of like, okay, in one of the things that happens in the Odyssey is Odysseus and his men get stranded on the island with the Cyclops. Yeah. And they have to escape from the Cyclops. And that's a great adventure story.
Yeah.
Or they get, trapped by Circe, the sorceress, and they have to escape Circe. Or they go to the island of the Lotus Eaters, and they have to escape the Lotus Eaters. And it's fascinating stuff. It's good storytelling. It's well told.
Right.
And even if there are some characters that appear in it that, you know, aren't real, like Neptune, who's the one that really has his nose out of joint with Odysseus.
Right.
That's kind of like watching a Marvel movie that's got a character like Thor in it. Yeah. You don't have to believe in the character to make it an interesting story. And it doesn't offend God as long as you're not personally tempted to worship Thor or Neptune or take all that seriously. As long as you're secure in your faith, it's perfectly fine to be aware of elements of pagan culture, including pagan literature. In fact, if you go to the Vatican Museums, one of the things you'll find, they've got a great statue of Laocoon there. Laocoon was a figure in Greek mythology who he and his sons were attacked by the gods with snakes. And you go into the Vatican Museums, and right there near the entrance, they've got this Laocoon with his sons and the snakes, and they're wrestling with the snakes. And it's an element that's straight out of pagan mythology. And they had this statue from Greco-Roman times, and they felt it's worth preserving and worth putting on display for people. And so we don't need to be threatened by these things. In fact, you know the room where they pick the Pope?
Yes, the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah. Yeah. There are elements of pagan thought there, too, because if you look on the walls, where Michelangelo and other painters have done their work, you'll find depictions of the Sibyl.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the Sibyl was a actually there was more than one, but the Sibyls were sort of pagan prophetesses. And there's a bunch of literature known as the Sibylline Oracles that actually contains Jewish and Christian elements in it. And so what it looks like is some early Christians wrote this stuff for purposes of evangelizing pagans.
Okay.
So they would put in the mouth of the Sibyl prophecies that would point towards Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, there's a kind of blending here where you have of cultures, where you have elements of Greco-Roman culture and Judeo-Christian culture coming together. And all the way down through history, the church has not been threatened by this. And as honoring the early evangelistic efforts to perhaps to help Christians or help pagans see the value of Christianity, they've even got the Sibyl painted right there in the Sistine Chapel, testifying to Jesus.
What do you think, Carlos?
Yes, sounds very good. Thank you very much for this information.
All right. Thank you, Carlos. Appreciate your call. It's open forum. You can ask Jimmy Akin whatever you like. If you're not a Christian person, if you're not a Catholic person, you should also feel welcome. 888-318-7884. We'll go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. Austin in Baton Rouge, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. So I have a little bit of dilemma that I got myself in, and I'm a little confused on how to get out of it. Maybe I have some misunderstandings in my question, and I would love for those to get fixed. So here's the question. So if I need an infallible authority to interpret the infallible Word of God in the Scriptures, then do I need an infallible authority to interpret what the Pope infallibly defines? Does that make sense? Or?
Yeah, I'm glad you raised this question because I see people kicking this subject around, and both Catholics and non-Catholics, and it seems to me that there are some fundamental misunderstandings in this area. And sometimes I think those lie on the part of Catholics, and sometimes I think they lie on the part of non-Catholics. The idea that Catholics must have an infallible authority in order to interpret the Bible is false. As stated, it is false. What you need to interpret the Bible is the ability to interpret, and that's something that you don't have to be infallible or have an outside authority in order to do. Everybody is capable, to one degree or another, of, you know, processing the information in the Bible. I mean, I'm assuming we're not talking about people who are severely mentally challenged and not verbal. Anybody who can process words can process what's in Scripture, whether they can read it or not. You know, someone could read it out loud in church, they could hear it, they could think about what it means. And so everybody who's verbal has the ability to interpret Scripture or any other linguistic utterance to one degree or another. And so we shouldn't misrepresent that, and we shouldn't allow ourselves to be misrepresented as claiming something we're not, because we don't, as Catholics claim, we need an infallible authority in order to be able to interpret Scripture at all. Now, are there situations where you would need an infallible authority? Sure. If you need an infallible interpretation, well, you're going to need to get it from somewhere. And if you're not personally infallible, and most of us aren't, even, you know, I mean, I'm not, I don't know about Psychelet, but most of us are not personally infallible. But if you need an infallible interpretation of a passage and you're not personally infallible, then yeah, then you would need an infallible authority to get an infallible interpretation. And that applies whether you're Catholic or not. So if there are situations where it's crucial that you be able to settle a question definitively and thus infallibly, then yeah, you would need an authority that can teach definitively or infallibly in those circumstances. But if you're not in those circumstances, then you don't. So that's kind of a general sketch I would, you know, apply to the principles, you know, in a general way. Is there a more specific application that you're looking for?
No. That really cleared up a lot. You know, just the assumption in the first part of the question was just false. And yeah, I have heard a lot of Catholics who say, yeah, you know, you need an infallible authority to interpret the infallible Word of God. I also heard that was in Trent, too.
Yeah, like Trent does. Trent does not use that language.
And we're talking about the Council of Trent, okay. Not Trent Horn now.
Yeah. By the way, one thing, and I think there's an additional point here that needs to be made, because sometimes, you know, this will be a point of discussion between Catholics and Protestants in particular. And sometimes Protestants will say, well, even if you have a pope, let's say, or a magisterium that can teach infallibly, you still have to interpret what they say. Yeah. And so you could make the argument that, well, you're not really any better off because you've still got to interpret what they say. And that's a mistake. That's an erroneous argument, because the difference between a text that's frozen like the Bible and a living magisterium is, right, if you get your interpretation of the magisterium wrong, the magisterium can correct you.
Right. Yeah.
So if the Pope comes out and says X is the truth, and you misunderstand it as Y is the truth rather than X, the Pope can say, no, 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 no. It's X, not Y.
Right.
Let me clarify that. And that doesn't happen with the Bible. If the Bible says X is the case,
yeah,
and you think Y is the case, and so you go on your podcast and say Y is the case, the Bible cannot go, oh, no, 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 no. It's really X. Because
yeah,
the Bible is a text that can't interact with you on an ongoing in-person basis or living basis the way a magisterium that's still around and interactive can. If we were in the days of the apostles, who were the magisterium of their day, then you could. If Paul writes something and you misunderstand him, Paul could correct you.
Right.
But now that the authors of the Bible and the magisterium have become separate, the Bible is not capable itself of correcting you, but the magisterium today is capable of correcting you the same way the magisterium in the first century could have corrected you.
Austin, thank you so much for those questions. Very, very interesting discussion. I appreciate that you brought that to us. It's open forum. Lots of folks on the line. Got to take a quick break, and we'll get back to those lines. Right now, the 20 Answers Reading Challenge continues. That means you can still get all 44 books when you buy the whole set together, 44 books in the Catholic Answers 20 Answers set. You get them for 70% off when you go to shop.catholic.com, and you get free shipping. Free shipping and 70% off when you buy the whole set, 44 books in the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers. Get it now at shop.catholic.com.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
I get up in the morning, I turn the radio on, listen to the Mass, listen to the early shows. I transition to my automobile, I flip it over on my iPhone, then start listening to it on the web. And then when I get in the car, I actually listen to it all the way to work. When I get to work, I actually even listen to it online while I'm sitting at my desk. I just love EWTN.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Special Friday open forum both hours today with Jimmy Akin. You're welcome to call 888-31-TRUTH with your question. And everybody's welcome. Whether you're Catholic or not, you are welcome to ask your question. Mike in Stuart, Florida is next listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. Mike, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy, longtime listener of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Honored to speak with you.
Awesome. Thank you.
I have a friend who says he believes in God, but as far as I can tell, it's not the God of classical theism. He believes God is some sort of collective consciousness, and given your background, I thought you'd be the best person I could ask on how to best approach him. I've tried Aquinas' argument from contingency, since this kind of consciousness would have to be contingent upon something else, but I lost him with that argument. How would you classify this type of argument? Is it some kind of New Age pantheism? You know, would using an evidential approach, like trying to prove Christ rose from the dead, be more effective?
Well, I'd have to know more about his view. Saying God is kind of a collective consciousness could be understood in different ways. I mean, my first question is, what, like the Borg?
Yeah.
You know, is this guy worshiping the Borg collective?
In which case, don't.
Yeah, it's just bad. If consciousness is going to be collective in the proper sense, then that implies it's something that's being shared among different specific individuals, either consciously or unconsciously. But I could also imagine him thinking, well, it's not really shared or generated by specific people, but maybe it's like a field of consciousness, and maybe we do or don't participate in it, but it's not generated by specific individuals the way the Borg collective consciousness is generated by the Borg.
Right.
Instead, maybe there's a view, it's called panpsychism, that like everything is conscious on some little bitty low level, and there's this consciousness field that gives rise to the universe. Do you happen to know how your friend is interpreting it along those lines, Mike?
Yeah, I think he views this collective consciousness as some sort of state that we all participate in. And isn't any other external factor.
Okay, so is, in his mind, is this consciousness field he calls God, is it generated by conscious beings, or is it something that precedes conscious beings?
is generated by conscious beings.
Interesting. So in his view, then, if that's his view, then there would seem to be a time prior to which God did not exist, because there was a time, at least based on all the evidence we have, prior to the arrival of conscious beings in the universe. Do you know if he would go that far, or would he disagree?
I'm not sure. I'd have to ask him. I guess if I could follow up, you know, and say, well, what if he believes that you know, this consciousness did come from something that pre-exists human beings?
Okay, so that would certainly be, to my mind, a better concept of God, something that pre-exists finite creatures like us rather than something that is generated by finite creatures like us. If it's something we generate, I would say it's hard to see why you should worship it, because then it's just worshiping a collective state of something people generate. And actually, you know, kind of the Nazis did that. And so, you know, it doesn't seem that worshiping the collective is that great of a thing to do when the collective is made up of schlubs like us. On the other hand, if he thinks that that it's something that precedes beings like us, well, that's at least more in the direction of how a classical theist would understand God. I would be curious then to think, well, how would he explain the existence of this consciousness field or collective or whatever it is? How did it come to be? And if he has an account for that, I mean, he might say there is no reason. It is fundamental. It is just God. It's always been there. And everything else comes from this field. So you have an uncreated intellect that gives rise to the created universe. And if he's saying that, he's much closer to classical theism than he otherwise might be. On the other hand, if he would say, no, there was a time when this consciousness field, God, did not exist, then I would want to know how he can account for where it comes from. And he might say, well, it came from, I hate to use a fancy word, but in philosophy it's called an epiphenomenon. He might say that consciousness and thus God is an epiphenomenon that arises from various physical states in the universe. And I would say, okay, let's talk about those physical states then. What are they? And how do we know scientifically that this field arises from them? It seems like we don't have any scientific evidence for that. He might have some philosophical arguments he would mount, and I would say, okay, tell me your arguments and let's look at them. Let's evaluate them. Let's look at the premises. Do the premises seem plausible or not? Are there other distinctions that need to be made? And so I try to enter into a dialogue with him. Now, at some point, it makes sense to present elements of and evidence for the Christian understanding to him. And sure, that can involve things like the contingency argument and other arguments that theists have developed for God's existence. It can also make sense to share the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus with him, and thus the fact that Jesus's message is to be trusted as evidenced by the fact Jesus rose from the dead. And then you can say, okay, well, how does Jesus conceptualize God? And it's not as a field of consciousness or a collective consciousness, unless you mean the Trinity by that. And even then, there would be some I's we'd need to dot and T's we'd need to cross to avoid misunderstandings. But it seems to me that a logical approach would be to understand his view as well as he can articulate it, and then ask him for the evidence that he has for his view, and then, you know, let him know about the Christian view and share with him various evidences for the Christian view. It seems to me that would be the fundamental strategy I'd take in dialoguing with such an individual. Mike?
Okay. Yeah, I did ask him, for example, about, whether where does this consciousness come from? You know, he said it just exists. And so I think you're right in that it is closer to the God of classical theism, but I couldn't get from there to, you know, the God of the Bible, essentially.
Mm-hmm. One thing you may want to ask him,
like the Bible.
Yeah, one thing you may want to ask him, if he says that God is this uncreated intellect, does he acknowledge that the physical world is distinct from God? Because that's another major thing that would help him be closer to theism, is if he's willing to say, yeah, there is an uncreated intellect that's responsible for the world and that is distinct from the world.
Mike, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Lines just keep staying full, so we're going to keep moving. Andrew in Midland, Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio. You're next, Andrew. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right. Hi, Jimmy. So my grandfather, you know, he used to be Catholic and believing in God and all that. And then so kind of like as his life went on, he began to develop this theory that at the beginning, like 6,000 years ago or so, when history first became recorded, that was when like alien scientists descended to the earth and like altered our DNA to make us the hyper intelligent beings we are. And so he believes that we're basically pre-programmed by these alien scientists before we're born. And I think it's like his excuse to not believe in God. And I'd just like to have some different counter arguments for that.
Okay.
Yep. All right.
So the first thing I'd be curious to know is what the basis is for his claim. Now, it is not contrary to the Christian faith to say that that intelligent aliens exist. It is not contrary to the Christian faith to say that intelligent aliens could have technology that would allow them to come to Earth, and or that they have come to Earth. That's not contrary to the Christian faith. And it's not contrary to the Christian faith to say aliens with technology came to Earth and did genetic engineering on us. So none of those things are contrary to the Christian faith. You know, there's nothing in the Bible or the teaching of the church that would say those things can't happen. So that in itself might be helpful for him to understand. But at the same time, just because those things are not incompatible in principle with the Christian faith doesn't mean that that they're probable. And so if you want to, if he wants you to think that this is true, then he should be able to give you some evidence for this. And once he provides evidence, that would enable you to evaluate the evidence with him. He may, for example, be a fan of a gentleman who wrote books a number of years ago named Zechariah Sitchin. Zechariah Sitchin claimed to be an expert in Mesopotamian languages, and he claimed to have a theory very much like this that that he came to. Although there are other people besides Zechariah Sitchin who have been into this kind of ancient astronaut area, and frankly, the evidence is not good. It involves either accidental or deliberate misreading of ancient sources. But in your grandfather's case, I would say finding out. You know, well, what's your version? Why do you think this? What evidence would you cite in favor of this idea? And then let's go through that, you know, and you don't have to be completely closed, because like I said, none of this is incompatible with the Christian faith. You, if he had good evidence, well, okay, fine. I'm pretty sure he doesn't. And if you, but if you approach it in a way that's friendly and fair-minded, you may be able to help him get a better evaluation of the evidence, and it's probably going to be negative. On the other hand, even if it was, even if he was right about his theory that there were aliens who were technologically advanced, who came here to Earth and did some genetic tinkering with humans, where did they come from and where did the universe come from? We still need an explanation for the rest of everything. And that explanation is going to be God. And so even if you believed that there were some aliens who came here and uplifted us genetically, that still doesn't rule out the existence of God. We still need God as an explanation for the universe overall and for everything that happens in it. And so in that case, these aliens would just be instruments that God was using as part of his providential design. And God may have intervened himself directly in the human line apart from anything aliens may have done. And so there are a bunch of other possibilities here. Ultimately, I would try to steer him towards Jesus Christ and the evidence for Jesus, because it's really Jesus that's the center of the gospel, and we have good evidence that he rose from the dead.
Andrew, if you'll hang on the line, I'd like to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense. It's got 366 different apologetics topics, and you just sound like such an intelligent young person and looking for answers to these things. I think you'll really enjoy this book. You hang on the line, and Thomas will get your information if you'd like, and we will send you that book. Hey, if you're on the line, stay on the line. Don't go anywhere. We're going to come back and continue Open Forum with Jimmy Akin in studio. And if you haven't dialed yet and you've got a question, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, the number, 888-318-7884.